So my lectures will be on
beyond the standard model of people's familiarity with various aspects of it. Means I haven't explained something well enough, so just prod me about it. And
it's an extremely broad topic. It's essentially the topic of antimatter asymmetry.
Antibaryons. And that's an enormous puzzle, and the standard model can... Okay, but the standard model doesn't explain the initial conditions.
Yeah.
So, but I agree. Veronica discussed neutrinos and neutrino masses a little bit. Where they come from, why they're so much smaller than all of the other... accumulation of evidence that there appears to be. This evidence is really... I'm not going to talk about evidence. It's really becoming overwhelming. It's not just... You know, the old story of galaxy rotation curves or the velocities of clusters of galaxies that is giving us evidence for dark matter. It's now cosmological and across many fronts. Even things like the Bullitt cluster, where clusters of galaxies have collided. And using gravitational lensing, we can map out where the matter is. We can also use X-rays to see where the visible matter is. And they don't coincide so well. So we know that there's dark matter. But we don't know what it is. This is an enormous problem. The origin of the three generations. And the mass patterns of the known quarks and leptons. The standard model, of course, completely accommodates the existence of the three generations and all of the different masses of the known fermions. But there are patterns there that are completely unexplained, but they really, no one could honestly look at the CKM matrix or the masses, the mass eigenvalues of the quarks and the mass eigenvalues of the charged leptons. No one could honestly look at those things and just think, well, I guess that's just the way they are, right? There's a clear pattern there. It's a hierarchical structure. And the standard model accommodates it, but does not tell us where it came from. It must have come from somewhere, and we don't know. There are even more highbrow questions. You know, what is the nature of the quantum nature of gravity? If we just take the standard model plus GR and do physics well above the Planck scale, we can't actually make sense of what the theory is telling us. So there must be something else, or at least some other understanding of the theory. I call this wouldn't normally be lumped in with beyond the standard model. But for me, it's beyond the standard model because it is beyond the standard model. Another thing that I will discuss in my last lecture, which is the lack of CP violation in the strong interaction. This is known as the strong CP problem. And out of all of this list, this is the first thing I've come to that I'm actually going to discuss in the last lecture. So there's a parameter in the standard model that we don't normally write down when we write down the renormalizable standard model. And this parameter, we don't normally write it down for a number of reasons, but it's a physical parameter. It leads to physical predictions, and it turns out that this parameter has to be extremely small. And we have no idea why it is. And the last thing that I will focus mostly on is the origin of the hierarchy between the M Planck and the electroweak scale.
Is that a separate algorithm? What's happened?
So the mass patterns. So as you saw in Veronica's lectures, the quark and lepton masses come from their interaction with the Higgs boson. So the pattern of masses is actually related not to the fact that there's the Higgs boson. The pattern of masses is related to the pattern of Yukawa's. But the overall scale of those masses depends on the scale of the electroweak scale, which is this guy here. This is V. You can think of this as being the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. So I was asked to discuss beyond the standard model physics broadly, but but to have some discussion on naturalness, which is this question of the origin of the hierarchy problem. We call it a hierarchy problem because we not only do we not know why this parameter is so much different from this parameter, but actually it appears that it's not even stable in quantum field theory for there to be a hierarchy, which is why it presents such a large problem. Out of all of these questions, probably the one that we have become most confused about in the last decade is this one. It's been something, you know, that has been a thorn in the side of our understanding of the Standard Model for decades. But the fact that the LHC has not observed anything at the weak scale puts enormous pressure on the proposed solutions to the hierarchy problem that we've had. So you might ask then, why am I going to discuss this? And the reason I'm going to discuss it is that the fact that we haven't discovered anything doesn't mean the hierarchy problem's gone away. It's actually become more acute. So it's, if anything, more relevant than it was a decade ago. But also, in the approaches that people have developed to the hierarchy problem, there are many tools that we use in theoretical physics, and especially in model building, which is in coming up with models that can explain these puzzles, that are put to use within any given proposal for explaining the hierarchy problem. And this toolkit is useful and is used for approaches to all of these other things. So this is I will focus on three lectures on the hierarchy problem, not just because it's a critical issue and beyond the Standard Model of physics, but also because the things you learn when learning about the hierarchy problem and proposed solutions feed through into understanding of all of these other things. That being said, the first to really understand the hierarchy problem and to understand actually the nature of a lot of these issues, one needs to learn some tools in quantum field theory that go a little bit beyond what you learned in the Standard Model course. Yep.
Do you not include dark energy on this list because it's just not something that you're going to be talking about, or for some other theoretical reason?
Ah, right, no, excellent question. Yeah, so dark energy I haven't put on this list because I think that's the thing we have least of a clue about. But we have I don't really have anything intelligent to say about it, right? It's these other things I can say something and teach you something, but I think with dark energy, you know, we don't know much. Like with there's a hierarchy problem that's more severe than this electroweak hierarchy problem, but the electroweak hierarchy problem, at least we have some ideas about how it may be resolved, that may play some part in the true story. With dark energy, we really don't know, but yes, let's add it. Dark energy. I won't talk about it, but it's definitely a big question. Super. Okay. So in the first three lectures, I want to discuss the hierarchy problem. But the first lecture today, I want to discuss these tools that we use in model building and tools that we use in quantum field theory. And then we will put them to use in the various models that we will come across. Now, the main tool that we tend to use is effective field theory. And for me, every field theory is an effective field theory to some degree or another.
Excuse me.
Yep.
Just before I go to effective field theory, are you going to explain like these questions later in the lectures? Or? I'm not sure what the origin of the generator problem is. Maybe most people know, but I don't know what exactly that is.
Well, so of
yes, this problem. I have no idea what that is.
So just like I said, it's, you know, there are the patterns of the masses of the quarks and leptons follow a very hierarchical structure, and we don't know why that is.
So it's like you observe the mass that forms some structure, and you suspect there's a mechanism that generates this.
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, and it goes beyond suspect. I mean, there's a clear pattern, but we don't know where that pattern comes from. So this comes under the banner of sort of flavor model building. People try to come up with models that can explain why that is. Why I'm not, I don't really want to discuss it, is that it, the energy scale or distance scale at which that
explanation exists. We have no idea. So at the moment, you can write down different models that explain that, those patterns. But the explanation might be so far out of experimental reach that we would never know. Whereas with this as well, another reason for thinking about the hierarchy problem is that we can probe any given solution. We can usually probe it and test it. But for these other things, my explanation of the problem is just what I said in the last 10 minutes. So effective field theory. So every theory is an effective field theory to some extent or another. Well, almost every theory. And the idea of effective field theory is in some sense, factorizing out the physics at smaller distance scales to come to a theory that is best and is most relevant for calculating any physical prediction in a theory. So, and it's really about going from the UV. We say UV. There's a lot of jargon, and you should press me if you're not familiar with any jargon. Jargon's extremely useful in rapidly conveying complex ideas, but it's only useful if you know what it means. So please press me. So UV, why do we say UV? UV is high energy. This is a throwback from a long time ago when high energy, the physics is still the same, but people talk about UV because that was short wavelengths, very short wavelengths, and short wavelengths correspond to high energies. Effective field theory is concerned with going from the UV to what we call the IR. By IR, I mean low energy, long wavelengths. Now, these no longer correspond to ultraviolet and infrared. UV could be the Planck scale, or it could be the electroweak scale, depending on what your problem you're talking about. And the IR could also be any sort of energy scale. And what this does, what effective field theory does, is gives you the appropriate description for the energy scale that you're working at. So for example, in the UV, we might talk about things like quarks and gluons scattering off each other. So it's something like the LHC. And this is the appropriate description if you're talking about processes that are occurring at energies of around, say, 100 GeV or maybe a TeV or something like that. But as you go to lower energies, if you go below the GeV scale, there's no point even talking about quarks and gluons because they're all confined into pions and protons and neutrons. So the effective theory that you would use at lower energies might involve, you know, pions, you know, scattering off protons or even, you know, helium nuclei or something like this. And for that, you would use the what's known as the chiral Lagrangian, which is just the correct effective theory for physical processes at that energy scale. And you can derive it to some degree, in principle, from the field theory relevant at these scales. But also, you can just use it in its own right and constrain its structure that way. And then you could go to even larger distance scales, which is even lower energies. And you wouldn't even want to use the chiral Lagrangian that deals with things like pions. You would want to use sort of electromagnetism and even nuclei. You could even treat them as point particles, and that's what we do in things like atomic physics. Of course, the distance scales are not necessarily related to what we actually do. The distance scales associated with how we access them. You know, for example, this is very short distance scale physics, but we use the LHC with its 27 kilometers, you know, near the Alps. And it's a very big experiment, but it's going to high energies to probe these things. You know, nuclear physics is at much lower energies, but it's still relatively high energy. And it's associated with things like, you know, nuclear fission and all sorts of things like that. And physics going on at this distance scale can also be macroscopic. You know, it can involve magnetism, things like this. So we see the effects of these different different physical processes macroscopically. Some big explosion. We see the effects of all of these things to some extent or another microscopically, and even shorter distance physics could affect, for example, the baryon asymmetry, which is, you know, cosmological. So when I'm talking about UV and IR, I'm not talking about the scale at which we see the effects, because we see all of these things in nature, but really the appropriate description for that, the energy scale of whatever, you know, sort of scattering process you're talking about.
Sorry, just a question.
Yep.
So is there any case in which it's the other way around, in which, like, the physics from the IR would influence the UV, or rather go in the other, like make an approximation in which you neglect the IR. Does that still count for EFT?
So a theory where you have a low energy theory, and that predicts the high energy. Not really. I don't know of any examples like that.
I'm kind of confused because like I read like the first few pages of like some EFT course, and he said like you have top down and bottom up EFTs.
Right.
And, if we try to build an EFT from the IR to the UV, we have to use random model degrees of freedom to like build that. So.
Yes. So absolutely. So I will come to that. So for an EFT, you can do it by top down and bottom up. What he will mean is that you can start with the UV theory and essentially derive the EFT at lower energies. Or if you don't know the UV theory, you can write down the general low energy theory that satisfies the symmetries and so on, and constrain its parameters, you know, experimentally. But you're not using that low energy theory to derive what the UV theory is. I hope that answers your question. So, and this is something that you're actually very, very familiar with. So there are many, many examples. You mentioned general relativity. You know, Newtonian gravity is a good effective field theory for as the IR of general relativity if you're talking about, for example, solar system dynamics. And often the EFT of some higher, you know, some UV theory was the first thing that's discovered. So, for example, with Newtonian gravity, that's very clear. Other examples include Fermi theory for example, decays of muons and electroweak processes. That was the effective theory that was valid at scales far below the electroweak scale. And it was a superb effective theory. But you can derive it, and we will do that directly from, you know, the Glashow-Salem-Weinberg SU2 cross U1 electroweak theory that you saw before. And we often refer to this when you go in this direction as the UV completion. You start with an IR theory, and it has some UV completion. That UV completion may not be unique, but we can find out what it is experimentally. Another example, which you may not be so familiar with, but you should look it up if you haven't seen this, because the analogy with the Standard Model is really quite stark, which is the Ginzburg-Landau theory of superconductivity. This theory had a scalar particle with charge 2, and it interacted with the photon. And this theory was not an attempt to tell you what was microscopically happening in a superconductor, but it was the right effective theory to describe the dynamics of the superconducting phase transition and so on. The UV completion of that theory was the BCS theory of superconductivity, which then explained, you know, by interactions between electrons essentially and phonons, you would get condensate of electrons, and that was essentially the charge 2 scalar. So this is not something that's just confined to particle physics. EFT, the rules of EFT are applied all over the place. But also you can see where this is going, because we have probed the Standard Model of particle physics at now, you know, the electroweak scale and slightly above at the LHC, but we don't actually know what the UV completion of that theory is. And that's the essence of what's behind the hierarchy problem. The Standard Model of particle physics, we have no reason to believe it's anything other than just the next layer of the onion of effective field theories, but we don't know what the UV completion is. Okay, so how do we work with effective field theories?
So could you ever have what is the definitive UV theory, or is that kind of like a platonic ideal of a chair?
No, it's a super question. So yeah, I mean, the hope would be that, you know, and this is one thing, for example, string theorists are after, or at least were after for a long time, the hope would be that you would find, you know, a unique UV theory with essentially no free parameters that would predict everything, and then all of the physics could be derived from that. But we don't know if that's possible. It looks like it's very difficult. But it's the goal. It's like, it's the reason we're all here, right? We want to know the reasons for what's going on in nature. And that's essentially finding the reason that the next layer of the explanation is going to the UV and finding what the UV completion is. Okay, so what are the rules of EFT? So, um, so these are just some basics. I'm going to spend this whole lecture just doing these going through these basics, but these are useful tools, and there are going to be some useful jargon that you may hear in passing conversation, will help explain various concepts later on. So the first is that an effective field theory in quantum field theory contains operators. So a field in quantum field theory is an operator. A field will create or annihilate particles, essentially. And in quantum field theory, you build up your Lagrangian, which Veronica did for the standard model, out of fields. So products of fields are operators, because products of operators are operators. And when you do this, then you will take every field in your theory, if you're being very general. You'll take every field in your theory and construct operators. So they will involve products of fields. And the rule is that anything goes, anything that's allowed by the symmetries of the theory, which I will get to next, should be written down. So for example, if you had a scalar field, if you had a scalar field phi, then your Lagrangian would contain the kinetic term, which you've seen before. A mass term. And you could have all sorts of terms all the way up to, phi to the 6 and so on. But we see that the scalar field carries mass dimension 1, because the Lagrangian, to get the action, you integrate over d4x, L. So we know that that L carries units of length to the minus 4. And by staring at that, you can see that the scalar field is carrying mass dimension 1. So in general, if you go to these what we call higher dimension operators, they should be made to carry the same dimension as the Lagrangian. So you would have, for example, some dimensionful parameter in the denominator like this. So that's why, and this is essentially what Fermi did when he wrote down Fermi's interaction. There are some things that we automatically do which are actually very important. For example, all of these operators are local. They involve the fields evaluated at the same space-time point. This is something you need to do if you want to have properties like causality being preserved and things like cluster decomposition, which is essentially related to the fact that you don't want the fact that you're doing an experiment over here to influence, say you're doing an experiment at the LHC, you don't want that to influence, some aliens in Alpha Centauri doing an experiment over there. The next thing is that your theory may have symmetries. So, for example, I could have included in this expansion, I'll call this C6 because it's the coefficient of phi to the 6. I could have had something like phi to the 5, C5. But my theory may have symmetries which constrain the form of some of the operators that you have. So a symmetry, if you're doing model building, it's something you'll put in by hand. You'll say, well, I know if I put in this, if my theory respects this symmetry, I will have a nice property. So that's what you do if you're model building, or it may be something that you measure because you know you're working with an EFT, you do some experiments, and you measure what all of these coefficients are, and you find that some of them are absent, so they must be absent for a reason, and it would be a symmetry. So for example, if we wanted to build a theory of dark matter, we would want our dark matter particle to be stable, and the easiest way to do that is for it to have a symmetry such that it can't decay into standard model particles. This absolute simplest symmetry that can do that for you is called a Z2 symmetry, which is a symmetry where, that you take the particle and you multiply it by minus 1 and the theory has to remain the same. So another example would be phi goes to minus phi, has to be a symmetry of the theory. You can see here, if I have that symmetry, it's respected. That symmetry is respected here and also here, but not by this operator. So a symmetry like this simple Z2 symmetry can forbid some operators in the EFT. Another property is that if you have these higher dimension operators, then typically scattering amplitudes will scale like some power of the energy over this parameter lambda squared. So for example, if one operator you could have written down, so we have this guy, we could have had also a quartic interaction, something like that. If we had, for example, another higher dimension operator that you could write down would be a quartic interaction with more derivatives, 1 over lambda squared, phi to the 4, box, sorry, phi squared, box, phi squared, where box is just d mu, d mu. Then if you scattered these scalars off of each other, you'd have a piece in the amplitude proportional to the self-interaction lambda, but you would also get a piece that goes like e over lambda all squared. This contains an enormous amount of information, both with regard to experiment and with regard to UV completion, because the first thing is that if you want to measure the coefficients of such operators, it tells you that if you're working at energies much below lambda, lambda's some energy scale, if you're working at energies much below lambda, then the effects of this operator will be very, very small. So there are two things you can do. You can go to higher energies and make this guy larger, and then his effects will be large and you can measure it. So like at the LHC, for example, if you had this operator for the Higgs boson, this is a perfectly fine operator to have for the Higgs boson. If we could scatter Higgs bosons off themselves, then we could measure the coefficient, and a good way to do that would be to go to high energies. Or to do experiments with extreme precision. If E over lambda is very small, but we can measure this whole thing with a very high accuracy, then we can hope to access it. The other thing is that we see that as E starts to approach lambda, the scattering amplitude starts to approach 1. And as we push E even higher, eventually the scattering amplitude will start to become so large that it will violate unitarity, essentially the predictions for the probabilities for scattering processes to happen, essentially cross sections, decay rates, all those sorts of things, the probabilities will start to become larger than 1, which means that is when we say unitarity is violated. And that doesn't tell you that that nature doesn't like to conserve probability. That tells you that you're using the wrong theory. Eventually, when you go to higher and higher energy, your effective field theory will no longer be valid. And you need to provide whatever the microscopic UV completion is in order to calculate things. Yep.
So going back to what you said about the symmetries, why did the Z2 symmetry prevent dark matter, for example, from decaying in the center?
Right, okay. Yep, great question. And it's very easy to answer. If there's a Z2 symmetry, then in any interaction, phi will appear at least twice or 4 times, or something like that. So there's no diagram you could ever write down where phi goes to stuff, unless there's another phi. But then it hasn't decayed.
Okay. Oh, so decay, you're saying decay is not the same as annihilate, though?
No, yeah, it can definitely annihilate. But if you want dark matter to be stable, impose a Z2 symmetry and you're good to go. And in fact, this is a good theory of dark matter, and if we add phi squared Higgs squared, then we can even have the interactions with the standard model to give it the right annihilations to get the right relic abundance. Great question. Okay. Then we often refer to lambda as the cutoff, which is the cutoff for the theory. It means there's no point trying to use that theory at energies above lambda, because it just won't make any sense. Above lambda, you should UV complete it. And this is exactly what would happen if you used the chiral Lagrangian for pions, for example, and you tried to apply it at energies of 100 GeV. It would be total nonsense. You would not get any physical predictions, and that's because you've reached the cutoff and you've gone above the cutoff, and you should really be using the true microscopic UV completion of that Lagrangian, which in our case is QCD. There's some additional information beyond symmetries, which we often refer to as power counting. So we may have some idea about what's going on in the UV that doesn't tell us exactly what the coefficients of the operators are, but may tell us some information about how they scale. So for example, yep.
Yeah, Is there an implicit C something in front of the one of the lambda squared pi squared box? Pi
yes,
squared?
Yeah, C. It's called C box or something. Oh, yes, some jargon. We often refer to these guys as Wilson coefficients because it was Wilson who sort of, not just Wilson, but Wilson developed the quantum field theory aspect of effective field theories, probably the most, and how these operators are generated from when you go from the UV to the IR. So we typically refer to them as Wilson coefficients. So another aspect is that we sometimes may have some idea about what's going on in the UV. So we have an idea of what we would normally call something like a power counting scheme that implies many things. It can tell you it can tell you where factors of 4 pi's go, or it can tell you, for example, if you have interactions of the photon with some fields in an effective field theory, then that interaction is probably going to involve the electromagnetic gauge coupling because it involves the photon and things like this. So you hear the phrase power counting applied in slightly different ways, but it usually means some notion about what the magnitudes of the Wilson coefficients will be. And the last thing is what I already said, which is the cutoff, which is where the theory breaks down. So for example, there's something that I didn't really fully flesh out. So as I said, that when the energy approaches lambda, it starts to break down. But the cutoff of the true cutoff of the theory doesn't actually have to be at lambda. And we will see this in a couple of different ways later. But the easiest way to see it is from the Fermi theory. So the Fermi theory is a 4 fermion interaction, which looks like G squared. It's a vector. There's also an axial part, but I'm just sketching this here over mw squared. So this combination G squared over mw squared is related to Fermi's constant. If you were to use this 4 fermion interaction at very high energies, so here lambda is actually mw over g, which is actually related to just v, the Vev of the Higgs field. If you were to start to use this at energies much above lambda, we know that it would break down, but actually it turns out that it breaks down before that because the true microscopic, we call it degrees of freedom, by which we mean new fields or particles, enter at mw. That's the actual mass scale of new particles. So we see that the UV completion is entering because these interactions are generated with a gauge boson. In this case, it's the W boson. And there's a propagator in here, which is going like 1 over p squared minus mw squared. When you expand out 1 over p squared minus mw squared, with p squared being very, very small, for example, when p squared is 0, when the energy transfer is 0, then you see that you can shrink this down together. You just get g squared over mw squared, which was this interaction here. But as you see that this, we could be using this effective field theory, not violating unitarity, but still get the wrong predictions because actually the UV completion doesn't kick up at lambda. It kicks in at mw over g. So which also tells us something that we will come to later, which is the difference between scales and interactions, mass scales and interaction scales. Okay, are there any questions so far? More questions? Nope. Okay. So,
how do you read off the amplitude? Does it have a linear?
Pardon?
Well, amplitude, why doesn't it have a linear correction? Just the amplitude, the 2 to 2, for example.
Lambda tilde.
Why does he have the linear correction?
This guy here.
Yeah.
Well, here because box has two derivatives.
Oh.
This is all very schematic. I'm going through this quickly to try and.
The confirmation thing. Mw does that imply that you have to be coupling to the W boson, it's not any other mediator?
No. So good question. So. In imagine there are new heavy bosons beyond the W boson.
Mm-hmm.
They can actually generate these interactions just like this, mm-hmm. which slightly shift the Wilson coefficient. They make it so it's g squared over mw squared. Let's call it 1 over lambda squared is g squared over mw squared, which is the bit coming from the W boson. But there might be some other contribution from some new heavy boson. Let's call it g tilde squared over m vector squared. So that we when we get to above the lecture week scale, we can explain this part of it, but there might actually still be a shift left over, and that's something that we're trying to measure. That's one way of looking for the presence of additional particles. You know, is the prediction for this exactly the same as what the standard model gives you, or is it something slightly different? And why one way that we can access this is, for example, that this affects the muon decays, this, you know, a muon decays via this operator. And a muon, we can measure the muon lifetime very, very accurately and then compare that with the predictions of the standard model and try to use this, you know, try to measure these higher dimension operators as a way of looking for new particles. Okay. There are some other, there's some more sort of technical jargon, which I think is worth knowing, and I will give it, use it in some, a very simple example that also illuminates some of the approaches to the hierarchy problem that I will discuss later. And this is the idea of spurions. This is more jargon that you will hear a lot, but it's a very, very useful piece of jargon. So the idea is, you know, imagine that there is a theory with some symmetry, some effective theory that has some symmetry, and then there's only one parameter in that, so one operator in that theory that breaks the symmetry. Then all of the quantum corrections, you know, you could draw as many loop diagrams as you want, all of the quantum corrections that lead to predictions for physical processes that involve breaking of that symmetry will involve that one parameter. Because if I take that one parameter and set it to zero, the full theory has a symmetry. That's essentially the idea behind spurions. If you didn't understand what I just said, which I don't expect you did, then the best way to see this is with an explicit example. So one example would be to take a complex scalar field and a fermion, a Weyl fermion. We'll give this complex scalar field a mass squared. And we'll give the Weyl fermion a Majorana mass. And then we'll have some the rest of the Lagrangian, which will have the interactions of these fields. And let's consider some particular examples. So let's.
Psi, you said, was a Majorana fermion or
a Majorana.
Okay.
Majorana. But I'm using the notation of a two component. A Majorana is really, you can write it as a four component spinner, but you can also write that as a two component spinner, which we call a Weyl spinner, but it's sort of the same thing. And I'm using that notation, but you can think of it as Majorana. This guy here?
Yes.
No, because this is a fermion, so he has mass dimension 3 over 2. Okay, so let's consider some limits. So imagine we take the limit that m phi goes to 0. In this limit, this part of the theory now has a shift symmetry, which is that we can take phi and shift it by some complex number. Let's call it C. Then the only place where you have 5, I've set this guy to 0, is here. And you see that if I shift this by a constant, the derivative just gives you 0 when it acts on the constant. So the theory respects that symmetry. So if all of the interactions in here also respect that symmetry, then it's a good symmetry of the theory whenever m phi goes to 0. So for example, if if you wanted this to be a symmetry of the theory, then all of these interactions would look something like d mu phi acting on some coupled to some operator, let's call it theta, that can contain any sorts of fields. If it always enters in, we can also raise this to some power, I guess. If phi always enters in here in this way, then you would have the shift symmetry respected. So now let's turn m phi back on again. We know that m phi is the only parameter in the theory that's breaking this symmetry. Yep.
Does n have to be on in order to have the contractions work out?
No, I mean, I'm being very schematic here. I mean, this could be
in order to have the in order not to have leftover index. So
So by this I mean any number of terms where there's always a derivative. There could be two derivatives acting on phi, or there could be multiple Lorentz indices here and multiple Lorentz indices.
Okay.
I'm not. One example would be this. If you just imagine this, then. But, so then we know that if we have a theory like this, if m phi is the only parameter that broke the shift symmetry, then no matter what loop corrections you might calculate to any sort of order, any parameters that Wilson coefficients or whatever that break the shift symmetry must be proportional to m phi, because if I take m phi to zero, then the symmetry is recovered. So what that tells you then is that, for example, quantum mechanically, this scalar phi, if these interactions respect the shift symmetry, will never get large corrections to its mass. There cannot be some large corrections coming from elsewhere that don't depend on m phi. Okay, let's consider another limit, which is m psi goes to zero. In this limit, we have a chiral symmetry, which is psi goes to e to the I theta psi. So you see here we have the Hermitian conjugate of psi and psi, so those terms would cancel there. Theta is just not some operator. Theta is just some constant phase. So if all of these interactions respect that symmetry, again, then we know that the only parameter that breaks that chiral symmetry is this parameter here, which means that, again, in quantum field theory, we will not get any large corrections to the mass of psi, you know, if we do loop calculations and so on, because psi is the only parameter that breaks the chiral symmetry. So this mass parameter, any corrections to it must be proportional to the mass, must be proportional to m psi. So psi can be naturally very light. It's not going to get any large corrections. So why this comes under the banner of spurions is that we call these parameters, it doesn't have to be mass parameters, it can be interactions and so on. We call them spurions because they help us keep track of symmetry breaking effects in the quantum field theory. Another symmetry arises if we consider the limit where m phi and m psi go to zero. In that instance, we actually can get a scale symmetry where we rescale all of the spatial coordinates by some rescaling, say, alpha, and we rescale the field by alpha, and then so x has gone like alpha, x has gone to alpha x, so d mu has gone to 1 over alpha d mu, and phi has gone to alpha phi, and you see that this term remains unchanged, this term remains unchanged. And if these interactions also have that scale symmetry, then the whole theory has a scale symmetry, which also tells you that these parameters here would be the spurions for scale symmetry breaking, and any effects that give you breaking of scale symmetry must be proportional to these two parameters. There's a caveat to that, which is that in quantum field theory, this symmetry can actually be broken quantum mechanically, and I will discuss that a little bit later on. But nonetheless, at least at the classical level, you can see that there's a scale symmetry in that limit. And the final limit I want to consider is when m phi is equal to m psi. And we will discuss this in a later lecture, but in this limit, whenever these two masses are identical, this part of the theory actually respects a symmetry which is supersymmetry. I'm not going to explain the details of that in this lecture, but we will come to it. But that means then that if all of these interactions also respect supersymmetry, then there will be no, whenever these two parameters are equal, there will be no large quantum corrections to their mass difference. They will stay the same. They will always stay at the same mass.
I'm sorry, I think I missed something.
Yep.
Spurion is a noun. What is the spurion in this example?
In this example, when they're equal, so these are all the symmetry limits. When they're equal, the spurion is zero. So the spurion in this case, if you were to make them not equal, is m. Good question. m phi minus m psi. Let's call that delta. So in the limit when delta is zero, if these interactions respect supersymmetry, then the theory is supersymmetric. So then if I were to introduce some small mass splitting between these two guys, if these interactions respect supersymmetry, then that mass splitting will never get large. It will always stay at the same scale, just like with these examples. But in that case, the spurion would be the difference in masses.
And in other cases, the spurion is the mass.
Yes, exactly. So if these interactions respect a shift symmetry on phi, then m phi is the only parameter in the game that breaks the shift symmetry. So it's the spurion.
The parameter is the spurion.
Right? Yes. Yeah. But it doesn't have to be a mass. In any example, it could be a coupling. It could be an interaction or a Wilson coefficient. It's just a case where if there's only one parameter in the theory that's breaking a symmetry, then you know that any symmetry breaking effects must always be proportional to that parameter. And this leads us on to the first, we're sort of getting towards the hierarchy problem now. A first observation, which is that small is not necessarily fine-tuned. So when we talk about the hierarchy problem, this will hopefully make clear that the hierarchy problem, you don't have necessarily a hierarchy problem if you just have a small parameter in your theory, because it can be perfectly fine to have small parameters in your theory. We will use this example of the chiral, what I call the chiral symmetry, to explain that. So if we look at where for example, the electron mass comes from, the standard model action contains a whole load of terms, and then it has the term that gives you the electron mass, which has the electron Yukawa, the Higgs. And so on. So this would be the right-handed electron spinner, vial spinner, and this is the left-handed electric doublet spinner. And we see here that lambda E is the only parameter. It breaks chiral symmetry where L goes to E to the I theta L and EC goes to E to the I theta EC. So this means then if there, and this is how the electron gets its mass, its Dirac mass. So this means then that any corrections in whatever the full theory is, any corrections to the electron mass, if this is the only parameter that breaks this chiral symmetry, any correction to the electron mass will always be proportional to this parameter.
Is it E subscript
N? Electron. So this tells you then that although the electron mass is very, very small, you know, ME is 511 keV, which is much smaller than, for example, the top quark mass or something like that. But we don't have a hierarchy problem for the electron mass. It's absolutely perfectly fine for it to be very, very small. There may be a puzzle which is associated with what I was talking about earlier about the origin of all of the different mass parameters. So lambda E is very small, and that is a puzzle in the sense of, well, where does this small number come from? But it's also perfectly acceptable in a quantum field theory for lambda E to be small. It's not unstable under quantum corrections. There are no loop diagrams that you can write down which will give the electron a very large mass correction. which is to say that the electron mass is not fine-tuned. Small is not necessarily fine-tuned. And this is essentially what is behind the notion of technical naturalness. actually. Technical naturalness or naturalness as a whole. Term technical naturalness by Gerard Tuft, but many other people, and when we use the word, when we talk about naturalness or hierarchy problems, we're really talking about this. Not about problems of numbers just being smaller than we expect, but of numbers being smaller than quantum corrections would want them to be. Okay.
So can you only have one spurion in a theory? Only one parameter that breaks a symmetry?
No, you could have multiple. But then, you know, you can use this, take this further to say that then any symmetry breaking effects will be proportional to one or other or a combination of both. Another way to think of this is you could assign them charges under your notional symmetry. So for example, in some cases it's easier to do than in others, but if we take, for example, this chiral symmetry, this is to say that there's a chiral symmetry, and if we imagine that phi has charge 1, then we can imagine that m phi is a parameter that has charge minus 2. So anywhere that it enters, it will enter like it has charge minus 2. Then if there was some other spurion that broke that chiral symmetry, it may have a different apparent charge. But in any process, any scattering amplitude or anything like this, it will always enter like it's carrying that charge.
It's just pretty, if you have a scale symmetry situation, by default, you're also going to have supersymmetry because you're taking both of these to the same limit. So how many spurions do you have in these?
Not by default, because you can, that's true for this bit, but these, in all these cases, the interactions have to respect the symmetry. So you can have interactions that have scale symmetry that don't respect supersymmetry. For example, if you take this theory here, if you just had this term and this term, you have a classical scale symmetry,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have supersymmetry because you don't even have a fermion.
Okay. So can you have both? What happens if you have both?
Oh yeah, sure. So there are many, many supersymmetric examples that are also have scale symmetries.
You have multiple spurions in the redundancies, or does one win?
Could you phrase the question slightly differently?
If you have both scale symmetry, if you have scale symmetry, it looks like you have two spurions.
Right.
If you have supersymmetry, you have one, it's a different one. Do you have three if you have both, or is there...
Right, well, yeah, if you have scale symmetry for this spurion, there is no mass difference because there's no mass.
Yes.
So if it's supersymmetric, there's always scale symmetry. There's always... This spurion is always zero.
Mm-hmm.
So you in any given example, you know. So for example, I'm you know, here, m phi is a parameter that carries scale, you know, scale charge essentially, but it also carries you know a charge that essentially breaks a shift parameter, a shift symmetry. But it depends on what's going on with the rest of this interaction. Like the example I gave, you know, you take the action and you stare at it and see.
I'm a bit confused about what you mean by scale symmetry. So what's the transformation?
Ah, yes, sure. So a scale symmetry would be, you know, if you take x mu to alpha x mu, and, you know, in this case, phi would go to alpha phi. And you see that this alpha to the minus 1 phi. So you need to absorb the whole theory is the integral over the Lagrangian. So you have d4x. In the Lagrangian. So this has gone to alpha to the 4, so we need this to go to alpha to the minus 4. So yeah, alpha 5 goes to alpha to the minus 4. But scale symmetry is a very, very, so this is related to conformal symmetry. And it's a very, very, in quantum field theories, it's a very, very special sort of symmetry because it can be broken by quantum effects. A good example is, I'm sure, did Veronica discuss the running of the coupling, the strong coupling parameter, how it changes with scale? Call it renormalization group evolution. So if you measure the QCD strong coupling at one scale and then measure at a different energy scale, it'll actually be different. It's changing. It gets weaker as you go to higher energies, even though the QCD part of the Lagrangian actually respects this sort of symmetry. But quantum mechanically, there are effects that change it. So you can have a symmetry that appears to be what we say a classical symmetry that is actually not quantum mechanically a symmetry.
Yep.
New question. You said that, oh, classically I have a scale symmetry, but not supersymmetry was if you had just those two terms, there was no fermion.
Yep.
But if you have no fermion, then there's no m psi, and so you have, you're just taking m phi to zero, and so what's the difference between the first case and scale symmetry case, because those are different transformations?
Sorry, can you...
If you remove m, if there's no fermion,
right,
then I don't see the difference between the first and the third case.
It's, again, it's like I, like I've said, it's to do with the interactions.
Okay.
So these interactions could, for example, if I had a an interaction like d mu phi to the 4 over lambda to the 4, this interaction violates scale symmetry but preserves the shift symmetry.
Okay.
Okie doke. Excellent. And one last thing. Which I will go over very quickly, and we saw over here with this example of the Fermi interaction, is that masses and scales are different things. And you can actually very systematically see the difference if you do the opposite of what we normally do as particle physicists, if you put h-bar back into the action. So h-bar carries units of energy times length. If you put it back into the action, you'll see it popping up all over the place. And when you do that, this is in my notes, and I don't want to spend any time on it, but you can look it up in the notes. What you find then is that masses and couplings carry different dimensions in units of h-bar, and it lets you spot this very quickly. So here we saw that the UV completion, the mass scale at which something came in, was related to the cutoff by a coupling. And that's essentially, depending on the type of the interaction, the relation can be different, but it's essentially always the case. And it's actually telling you something very, very deep, which is that if you measure some higher dimension operator in your effective field theory, you might notionally think, well, the UV completion has to kick in at lambda because that's the energy scale where the amplitudes hit 1 and blah, blah, blah. But actually, it could be much, much smaller if there's a small coupling in the theory. And you can see that here. Imagine G were very, very small. Then we get a very large lambda, even for a very small MW. And this is also the case for M Planck. So another higher dimension operator that we like to consider is the interaction of the graviton with the stress energy tensor of the standard model. When you do a similar analysis for this interaction, you see that M Planck does not carry units of mass. The Planck scale is not a Planck mass until you put an h-bar in it. So it actually carries dimensions of mass divided by coupling. And this can then tell you, sort of like with these Spurion arguments, how this parameter could enter into quantum corrections. If it enters, it will always enter like a mass divided by a coupling. Which also tells you then you will never get mass corrections. So sometimes you hear people say, you know, the Higgs mass could get corrections like M Planck squared, or the cosmological constant could get corrections like M Planck to the fourth. They will actually, well, for the cosmological constant it's a bit different, but for the Higgs mass, there's no theory you could write down where the Higgs mass gets a correction that goes like M Planck squared, because M Planck does not have units of mass. It will always have a coupling. So it might be lambda top M Planck squared, G electro weak squared M Planck squared or something like that. But this is another useful trick. It's detailed more in my notes, but this is another useful trick of seeing how parameters will enter your effective field theory at whatever order in perturbation theory or something like that.
Did you say M Planck does not have units of mass?
Yes.
What are the units of the Planck mass if they're not mass?
You put an h-bar in, so as I was saying.
I don't think I understood that statement because
when we set h-bar to 1,
okay,
it carries units of mass. But in any theory, if you put h-bar not equal to 1, keep h-bar in your theory, then the Planck scale, or the interaction scale that we normally call M Planck, is not a mass scale. It's related to a mass scale by a coupling. Only when you set h-bar to 1, you associate, because h-bar carries units of energy and length.
So it really only makes sense to call Planck mass in natural units.
Right.
It's not a it's a totally different object outside of that.
Right.
Okay.
So when we set h-bar to 1, we're actually setting energy equivalent to length to the -1.
Okay.
when we do that. And this is just a trick. This is a useful way of seeing how things will enter quantum mechanics.
Tricky speaking, you meant HRC there, probably, right?
Yeah, I've already set length and time.
just using non-standard units.
Yeah. I've never come across an instance where putting that C back into the action helps, but... Okay, so in the last 12 minutes, we're going to eat up a little bit of soccer time. How many people actually want to watch the soccer, by the way, just to give me an idea? Yeah. Okay, so I will be quick. I will try and be quick, and we may have to make up a little bit of time elsewhere, but this is fine. So the hierarchy problem. Work over here. To understand the hierarchy problem, sort of requires all of these notions. I could have just written down a loop diagram with the Higgs mass correction and a quadratic cutoff in the loop diagram and told you that it was a problem. But I wanted to flesh it out a little bit better, also because I think understanding all of these little bits and bobs of effective field theory are useful if you're doing dark matter phenomenology or even if you're doing condensed matter physics. This is all useful stuff. But now let's talk about the hierarchy problem. So to talk about the hierarchy problem, I don't want to talk about the Higgs for 10 minutes, but I want to talk about QCD again. So below the QCD strong coupling scale, let's call this lambda is, you know, a few GeV, or even a GeV. Below that strong coupling scale, you have a bunch of resonances, like the rho meson and so on. But then we have these light guys, which are the pions. And they are quite a bit lighter than the QCD scale. They're around 135. MeV, 135 MeV, 140 MeV. And they're also very, very close in mass. That's 135 MeV, this is 140 MeV, which sort of telling you, like I said, you can sometimes infer that there's a symmetry when you measure your effective theory and see that there's evidence for non-trivial relationships between the Wilson coefficients. In this case, the Wilson coefficient is just the mass parameter, that they're all very close together. And it's actually a good idea to think of the three of them as being packaged, once you know about QCD, the three of them as being packaged into an SU2 triplet of a global symmetry. And the way we do this is we use what's called the nonlinear parameterization. So very quickly, Veronica discussed spontaneous symmetry breaking, but if you had, for example, so you will be probably familiar with this, but I'll just go over it quickly. If you had a complex scalar field, you could write it as phi real plus I phi imaginary. But you could also equivalently write it as something like rho e to the I pi. So you have 2 degrees of freedom in a complex field. You have the real and the imaginary part. But I can package them however I wish. And one way of packaging them would be in this way, and we call this guy the radial field, the radial mode. And this guy would be, and we'd normally refer to it as the pion. So this is a field, not the number pi.
And can you only do that for a non-fermionic field? Because I feel like for Grassmann, you can't do that.
You can also do it for Grassmann variables. We'll see that when we go to supersymmetry. But it.
That, I mean, that specific reorganization, I don't think works because I tried it.
How you do it for fermionic fields is, for example, in the case of supersymmetry, is pi would be what we call a superfield. We will get to it, but you can do nonlinear realizations where you have fermions living in here as well. So this is how we can parameterize a complex scalar field, and when we have a spontaneously broken symmetry, then that's when this guy here gets a VEV. It's a vacuum expectation value. And it's much easier to work. You know, you can see the physics much more clearly if you work in this parameterization where the VEV is now a VEV of the radial mode. So when this field has a non-zero vacuum expectation value everywhere, and we can parameterize this field as something like rho plus f over root 2, where f is the background expectation value of rho, e to the I pi, where this is the argument, but this is still a field, it's not the number pi. And it turns out that it's much easier to work with, once you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, with an action of this form, and we call this the non-linear parameterization of the symmetry, because when you act on this guy with, for example, a U1 rotation, you multiply it by e to the I theta, phi actually transforms as a shift of theta. You take e to the I theta, which would be the U1 symmetry acting on this guy, on pi, then you get a shift in this angular variable here. So rho e to the I theta, pi, sorry, goes to rho e to the I pi plus theta. So we say that the symmetry is still there, but it's non-linearly realized. For pions, you want to do a similar thing, except it's non-abelian, but it turns out you can do it. So we package the pions into some big pion field that is parameterized in a similar way with this non-linear parameterization, where it would now be like e to the I pi, where this would be each of the three pions, and a Pauli matrix all divided by the pion decay constant, and then we would usually put f pi at the front. And then we can parameterize their masses. So this is because we've had spontaneous symmetry breaking, but I just want to look at the low energy effective theory and we will study it. You can parameterize their masses from a term in the action that goes like, trace of this big pion field. And in the end of the day, this gives you 1/2 m pi squared pi 0 squared plus 2 mod pi plus squared, for example. I'm treating this as a complex field rather than two real fields, but it has the same mass. If you calculate the mass of this complex field, you don't need that factor of 1/2. And it turns out when you study all of the pion interactions to a very good approximation, they preserve this shift symmetry that I discussed before. So this pion mass term is the only parameter that's breaking the shift symmetry on the pions. And that's why we can understand that the pions are so much lighter than all of the other QCD fields. The pions have an approximate shift symmetry, which is related to spontaneous symmetry breaking, which I will come to later. But for our purposes, that shift symmetry is the thing that keeps them light. Moreover, we see that there's also an approximate SU2 symmetry where these guys are all packaged together. I could have written this as 1/2 m pi squared pi 0 squared plus pi 1 squared plus pi 2 squared. And there, you can see this is an SO3 symmetry, but it's related to the SU2 symmetry if they're packaged in this way, which not only explains why they're light, because this is the only parameter that breaks the shift symmetry, so it's a sort of a spurion for the shift symmetry breaking, but also can explain the SU2 symmetry, can explain why they all have the same mass as well. But there's a big elephant in the room, not just the football match, a different elephant, which is that our theory doesn't actually respect this SU2 symmetry, which packages them all nicely together and give them all the same mass. Our theory, the elephant in the room in our theory, is that the charged pions are charged and the neutral pion is not. So if we look at the kinetic terms and their interactions with the photons in the pion effective theory, this was the mass term, but they also have the normal kinetic terms. They look like this. Okay, so this term here respects the shift symmetry on pi 0. But this term here, we can see that if I shift pi plus, because I've now got A, I've explicitly broken this shift symmetry. There's no shift symmetry on the pion because of this parameter E. So we can think of this, the charge of the pion, the electromagnetic coupling, as being as being a parameter that breaks the shift symmetry of the pi plus. So then we should write down all of the terms, according to the rules of EFT, all of the terms that we're allowed where the shift symmetry of the pi plus is broken by terms that involve E. So there's no way to forbid a term that goes something like 1 over lambda squared, where lambda is the cutoff, E squared mod pi plus squared. Another way to see this is that at loop order, if you were to calculate loops involving the photon and the charged pions, you would see that there's quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. That's one way of phrasing it. But in an EFT, you can already see that there should be terms of this magnitude. So there's actually no reason to believe that the charged pions should have the same mass or very close mass to the neutral pions at all, because there's no symmetry that could protect them. That could protect the charged pions from getting a large mass correction. So what do you do? The answer is that, well, you take the effective theory seriously and just believe what it's telling you, which is that these corrections should be there. And they are there, which then tells you that the cutoff of the theory, some new physics, if this guy is 135 GeV and this guy is 140 GeV and this guy is 135 GeV, plug those numbers in here, that tells you that, MeV, that tells you that these guys, that this parameter here can't be much larger than say 500, 600, 700 MeV or something like that. There must be new physics around the corner because this correction to the charged pion mass should be present in the EFT. What actually happens is that your naive EFT expectations are absolutely correct. And there is new physics in the form of the rho mesons and other vector mesons. And in QCD, you can actually calculate what the correction to the charged pion mass is. And it is as a formula that looks like this. Three E squared over 4 pi squared. You don't need to copy this down. It's just for illustration. M rho squared, M A squared, M rho squared, where rho is the vector meson. And M A1 is also a vector meson. There's a log of the mass ratio of the two of them. So indeed, these guys have mass around 700 MeV or so. The expectations were correct, and the mass splitting is exactly matches extremely well the observed mass splitting between 135 MeV and 140 MeV. So that's QCD. Naive EFT worked very well. We learned that there should be quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff because there's a parameter that's totally breaking the shift symmetry of the pion. It turns out that quadratic sensitivity is absolutely there. But before even calculating it, we knew that the cutoff of the theory can't be too far away, otherwise the mass splitting would be much larger than observed. The problem with the Higgs is that we do exactly the same thing, and I will discuss this tomorrow. You do exactly the same thing. We have not only the gauge interactions of the Higgs boson, which break any shift symmetry that it could have had, but also the Yukawa couplings of the Higgs boson, and also even the self-interaction of the Higgs boson. All of these interactions break any symmetry that could have kept the Higgs boson light. There should be corrections of this form. I can draw loop diagrams, but it's much more general than drawing loop diagrams. There should be corrections of this form for the Higgs boson mass, so the Higgs boson would want to be much heavier than 125 GeV, for example, unless this cutoff, where new physics enters, is less than, say, 500 or 600 GeV. So we apply exactly the same thing we learned from QCD to the electroweak sector, and it tells us that there should be new physics just around the corner because the Higgs mass is quadratically sensitive to the cutoff, but we haven't observed anything, and that is the hierarchy problem, essentially. And I'll leave it there. Are any questions before we...
So because the mass of the pions are not exactly the same, you expected an interaction term that broke shift symmetry, because otherwise it would
the parameter would have been a spurion.
No, it's more that we know that there's a coupling that breaks the shift symmetry, which was that the charged pion couples to the photon. So there's no symmetry that's now keeping the mass of the charged pion and the neutral pion the same. Because this is breaking the shift symmetry, but this one doesn't, so this will lead to different quantum corrections to its mass than this one. But we observe that they're actually very close in mass, which means that the corrections from the UV because of this interaction can't be too big, because we observe the mass splitting to be very small. And the corrections tell us that they scale like this, and this guy here, if we plug 135 MeV and minus 145 MeV into corrections that look like this, they tell you that lambda shouldn't be much higher than, say, 700 MeV or something like that. And that is absolutely correct. That's exactly what happens. The new physics that kicks in at that scale is the rho meson and the other vector mesons. So the argument is that, you should take your effective theory seriously. If you completely break a symmetry that could have kept something light, then there will be corrections from the UV involving that symmetry breaking pattern. If I set E to zero, then this correction goes away, and the charged pions could stay light, and they could stay at, for example, the same mass as the neutral pions. Does that answer your question?
Probably.
Any other questions? Nope. Okay, I guess we should give over to...